When you're texting while you drive, you can't be watching the road all the time. And that's a problem when you encounter other people. A Utah college student found that out when he hit and killed two rocket scientists while texting on a drive through the Rocky Mountains. With the rise in accidents such as these, scientists are studying what happens to the human brain when we divide our attention and how technology is affecting us. Joining me now on the line is New York Times reporter Matt Richtel, who tells the story of the Utah college student from the accident through the court case in his new book, A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. Matt won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for his series of stories on the hazardous use of cell phones. And Matt Richtel, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, tell us about this case of the college student Reggie Shaw. There are so many instances of texting while driving in deadly accidents. Why did you opt to focus on this one?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. I mean, it goes to the heart of the thing that made this so irresistible for me. This, even though it is a tragedy, is an truly incredible story with truly incredible characters. I mean, they're real, but the tensions in this story created when an all-American kid kills two rocket scientists while texting, then denies it, then becomes subject of a gumshoe, tenacious investigation, a first-ever prosecution, and then he goes on to admit what he's done and changes the world. I just couldn't take my eyes off this story. It's something you couldn't make up if you wanted to.
Who were the two victims, Matt?
The victims on this morning, may I tell you just a bit about the crash?
Yes, please.
Would it be worth telling you?
Yes.
So the young man who caused the crash is named Reggie Shaw. He is 19 years old when this happens on September 22, 2006. It's 6:30 in the morning in the northernmost county of Utah. It is freezing rain. It is dark. And behind Reggie, going 55 miles an hour, is a horseshoe maker with a trailer carrying 2 tons of horseshoes and horseshoe-making equipment. This is a missile at highway speeds. And coming the other direction, you asked about these victims, are two remarkable men, honestly. They're rocket scientists. They are building the booster for the next space shuttle, Jim Fafaro and Keith Odell. And Reggie, our 19-year-old, slips across the yellow divider, clips their Saturn carrying these rocket scientists. It spins across the road and is broadsided by the horseshoe maker in a collision so violent that our rocket scientists die instantly.
I can just almost see it as you're describing it here. So Reggie Shaw, he adamantly denies doing it. He eventually changed his mind, Matt.
Well, yes.
Why?
Yeah, sorry, let me just give you one more bit. I mentioned this story and these characters. So he pulls 100 yards down the road and says, I don't know what happened. He's unhurt. His Chevy Tahoe is virtually unscathed. He says, maybe I hydroplaned, but a tenacious state trooper shows up first on the scene, and he notices that Reggie is texting, and he's doing it with one hand. And this trooper says, "I realized he is a one-hander." Mm. And even though there's no legal precedent at the time, he becomes determined to find out if Reggie is texting. And guess what? Over 18 months, while Reggie denies it, gets a lawyer. He and his family say, you can't prove this. They discover that Reggie was, in fact, texting 11 times in the minutes and seconds around the crash and maybe right at the crash.
Because these days, Matt, you can find that kind of stuff out, right?
You can find it out these days. It's a little easier, but still not that easy. And then in 2006, it took literally 18 months to figure out the phone records. You know, meantime, there's no legal precedent in northern Utah, and the prosecutors are saying, well, even if we find this out, like, how do we prove he was doing this at the exact moment? How do we understand that, you know, the distraction actually caused the wreck? There are questions we're still asking today, but then boiling in this little community in northern Utah were all these sides coming together, beginning to ask a question, how much attention are we required to pay on the road? What should the law say? And it all comes to a head in a pretrial hearing 2 years after the accident, where a scientist from University of Utah begins to talk about what was going on inside Reggie's brain, what was causing this distraction, and lo and behold, Reggie says, "Oh my gosh, I realize my brain was divided in two. I did it," and he comes clean.
Wow. What a story. Well, we're talking this morning about the dangers of texting while driving. We're visiting with New York Times reporter Matt Richtel, who's author of A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. And we're also joined now by University of Kansas researcher Paul Atchley, who has focused on this whole idea of divided attention and the dangers of texting while driving. You know, one of the big issues here, Matt, and you talk about this so much in the book, is you say that the smartphone brilliantly exploits two types of attention, top-down and bottom-up. What's the difference?
Yeah. First, let me just say, Paul Atchley, who's on the line with us, is a major character in this book and a very fascinating scientist, so I should let him explain better than I. But look, here's where this book goes. This is not a question of whether texting and driving is dangerous. What this book goes into pointedly is asking the question, how come if we know that, we can't stop? Here's the difference between bottom-up and top-down attention. Paul will forgive me. He's heard me use this analogy before. Picture a cave person looking at a fire. Tending to the fire takes your top-down attention. It takes the part of your brain at the front of your head that it makes you most human, that it lets you focus your attention. But if you hear a lion's roar, that gets your bottom-up attention, your survival instinct, and it sends a message to the front part of your brain saying, lion, run. Bottom-up is what you can't control. It's a survival instinct. Top-down is the thing that makes us most human. And when you're driving in the car, focusing on the road takes your top-down attention. But when the phone rings, it sends a signal from your bottom-up attention, and it's very hard to resist, just like the lion's roar.
Yeah, Paul, explain that a little bit more. Why can't we give up cell phones? Why are they so intoxicating for us all?
Yeah, part of it is this idea that they are attracting your attention. They're hijacking your attention, even if you don't want them to, because they do have value to us. I mean, really, if you think about what a phone does, a phone is equivalent, think about that caveman, to someone walking up behind that cave person and tapping them on the shoulder. In that instance, the cave person knows that it's someone in their small social group that knows them and now wants to get their attention. And so, of course, they're going to turn and look and find out what's going on. The phone is equivalent to that sort of tap on the shoulder. It's telling you, you have someone that knows you that wants to reach out and talk to you or send you information. And so you, of course, turn and look, or in this case, you pick up the phone and read it. So these phones are so compelling to us because they're giving the brain something that we desperately need, social information. And if we ignore social information, there are all sorts of negative repercussions, both from maybe your partner being mad because you ignored their text, or if you take it to the extreme, depression. People who are depressed completely withdraw from that kind of social contact. So they're just wired into us in a very, very important way.
And something else in this book that I didn't realize, Paul, and Matt discusses this in the book, this notion that drivers are impaired for up to 15 seconds after they text, far longer than most drivers would ever think. What's going on there?
Right. I mean, we think we don't multitask. I've said that before. And
you can't do two things at one time. That's one of your big themes. Yeah.
Right. We know if you walk and chew gum at the same time, it's a 10% effect on your memory system. I mean, we literally can't do multiple things at the same time.
But you do get fresh breath.
You do get fresh breath, which is very important, especially for social contact. But we task switch. We switch between tasks, and the brain sort of disguises from us that when we're on task A, we're not really doing task B. And so when we make that switch, there's a cost. I'll put it in a circumstance that most listeners will probably understand. You know, you're working, you get an email, it comes in, you respond to the email, and then you try to get back into your workflow. Well, you know, it takes you some time to actually figure out where you were in that previous task, what you were doing. And in fact, IBM and Intel have both done studies of this, and they find it takes workers 15 to 25 minutes to get back on task after dealing with email. So a lot of companies have stopped people from multitasking and have them actually focus. But when you're task switching, you're talking on a phone and then you're trying to drive at the same time. Your brain, it takes some time to readjust to, okay, now I'm looking at the world. Where am I? I just drove for a couple of seconds without really paying attention. You have to now rescan, reevaluate, and it takes time for the brain to do all those things.
You know, Matt, and you guys are explaining all this so well, and I appreciate it. But one of the big questions, it seems to me, that looms over all of this, Matt, is this idea of why do people choose to text and drive even when they know they shouldn't be doing it? We've all heard that message a million times, but so many folks still do it. Why?
Well, so there's two things. Paul and I have been getting into some of the one of the reasons why is it's very hard to resist the tap on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what it's going to be. But then here's the part where also we really fool ourselves, and Dr. Ashley Paul speaks very eloquently to this as well. You get away with it a lot.
Yes.
And the reason you get – so what you wind up with is this sample group that says, oh, 100% of the time I didn't get in an accident, therefore I never will. And here's the thing. When Paul was talking about that switching cost, so in other words, you have to reorient to the road, a lot of times you have somewhat of a margin for error. The car in front of you is 20 yards ahead. So by the time you look up and you hit the brakes, you're okay. But look, 33,000 to 40,000 people are dying a year on the road. And what those cases represent are when you have milliseconds to react and your brain is unable to reorient in time. So you ask the question, and I'll go back to answer it directly. Reason one is because this stuff is addictive, and we haven't even gotten to all the reasons why. And number two is because people get away with it right up until they don't, and then someone dies.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about why this is so addictive. And we'll also talk about Reggie Shaw, the driver who caused this deadly accident out in Utah, and his transformation to crusader against texting and driving. And we're back. I'm Steve Prasky. We're talking about the dangers of texting while driving with University of Kansas researcher Paul Atchley and New York Times reporter Matt Richtel, author of A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. We were talking about this notion of you can't do two things at once, Paul, before our break. So how does being impaired by a smartphone, Paul, compare to being impaired by drunken driving?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up the drunken driving. I want to just briefly turn back to this question. We were talking about why people do it. I mean, it's very clear that people understand how risky texting and driving is. And in fact, as we've done, if you ask people if there's a crash, who's more responsible, the drunk driver or the texting driver, they'll tell you the texting driver is actually more responsible for the crash than the drunk driver.
Hmm.
And yet, I think that that's because people have done it and they know how bad it is. So they understand how impaired they are. And yet they do it anyway. And part of the reason, and Matt's talked about a couple of them, is because when you do it, it actually, because you're doing something you know is unsafe, your brain has to make a decision. I'm doing something unsafe. Am I doing it because I'm a bad person? Or is the road actually much safer than it looks? And what we find is people actually judge the road to become safer when they're engaged in this very dangerous process of texting and driving. It literally changes how safe you perceive the driving conditions to be. But there's no question, texting is incredibly dangerous. It's kind of the unholy trinity of risk. Your eyes are off the road. Your hands are not fully on the wheel. Your brain is not on the task at hand. It's difficult to come up with estimates. Really, the only number we have to go on is from some studies at Virginia Tech. It might be as much as, let's say, 4 to 6 times as risky as drunk driving.
Man. Well, Matt. No, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, something that Matt touched on with drunk driving. I mean, I hate to say this, but many times drunk drivers drive home safely. right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the 70s and 60s, before the drunk driving laws got strong, a police officer would pull you over and say, well, ma'am, sir, let's just get you home safely tonight. And they'd follow you home, or they might call you a cab. A lot of people do successfully drive drunk. But as Matt points out, there are many things that we can do safe 95% of the time that are still incredibly irresponsible and have no value for us. Driving drunk has no value. I don't think sending a text has a value in a car. And we should be legislating against. That's a personal opinion, but I think it's shared by a number of folks.
And Paul, just quickly, do you see our behaviors changing? I'm speaking about this from a national perspective. Are people getting the message? Are they changing their behaviors or not?
I'll give you the sad answer to that. And drunk driving is a great way to look at this. It wasn't really until May 13th, 1980, when Candace Leitner lost her 13-year-old daughter to a multiply convicted drunk driver, that we started to get legislatures to start to enforce laws that were already on the books. The first drunk driving law went into effect in 1917 in New York, I believe.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until the 80s where we started to enforce laws we already had. Now, what happened was we enforced those laws because we had these horrible cases that we could see. And those were used to sort of embarrass the legislators into acting. What happened was once those laws started to become enforced, people stopped driving drunk, not necessarily because they thought it was wrong. They always knew it was wrong, but because they knew there was a penalty associated with it.
Hmm.
And then what happened was, as they stopped engaging in the behavior, their brain was faced with a choice. Either I'm stopping driving drunk because I'm afraid of being fined, or I'm stopping driving drunk because it's unsafe. And what we discover is when you change a behavior, attitude shifts. We typically think you change someone's attitude, then the behavior changes. That's not the best path. You change a behavior, and then the attitude follows up with that behavior.
Hmm.
So what will have to happen is everyone knows texting and driving is unsafe. Everyone thinks we should do something about it. But what's going to have to happen in order to really change attitudes is we have to focus on behaviors. We have to have laws. They have to be enforced, and we have to have education around that.
Yeah.
And then we'll see the change that we want.
Matt Richtel, I wanted to come back to you and talk to you about Reggie Shaw, again, the 19-year-old college student who caused the accident that spurred your book, A Deadly Wandering. You know, Reggie made this remarkable transformation from denier of what he had done to crusader against texting and driving, which he's doing today. Tell us about that process. How did he go from point A to point B?
Yeah. I mean, we started this conversation where What drew me to this as a writer was I wanted to tell a great story. I just didn't want to write a white paper about the brain. And Reggie not only was this incredible gumshoe investigation and then historic prosecution, but this transformation. So after he says, I did it, he takes a plea bargain. And that entails doing a little bit of community service and serving 30 days of jail time, of which he serves 18. But then going well beyond the little bit of community service he was required to do, it was if over the 2.5 years of denials, he had built up such a wellspring of guilt and shame and sadness that it poured out in a veritable tsunami, and he became arguably the most important voice opposing texting and driving in the country, tantamount to this woman, Candace Leitner, who started MAD. Although Reggie hasn't started an organization, he's spoken hundreds of times to high schools, in front of federal agencies, in front of the NBA, in front of this is an all-American kid who played basketball and once dreamed of being in the NBA, and now he gets on his knees in front of NBA players and sobs and begs, please do not become me. The former Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, calls him a hero. The prosecutors and judge who prosecuted him say, we've never seen anyone redeem themselves like Reggie has redeemed himself. You know, I just had a note the other day from a reader saying, my family thinks I'm ignoring them, but I was sobbing as I read the end of your book, watching this kid transform. You know, I don't encourage ignoring your family, but that's the kind of reaction that Reggie elicits and deserves to.
And just quickly, Matt, you got such remarkable access to Reggie and his family. You got it how?
Well, thank you for asking that question. Perhaps it's the most surprising thing to me about this book. He, his family, the prosecutors, the victim's advocate, the people in the community just opened themselves up. They shared deeply, deeply personal stories that make this a truly human drama. And how did they do it? I don't know. Every day I would get off the phone and say to my wife after these reporting sessions, I am so gratified to be a vessel for these stories. I honestly don't know. They just did. They just shared.
That's the voice of New York Times reporter Matt Richtel. Again, he's the author of A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. We also were joined by KU researcher Paul Atchley. And gentlemen, what an important conversation for us to have. Thank you both for taking some time with us today.